The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, the weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is the best way for you to keep on top of all the latest news from China in just a few minutes a day with our free email newsletter, our handy smartphone app, and of course, at the website subchina.com. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I am in New York today. I am joined from the thickets and brambles of storied Goldcorn Holler by Jeremy. Get off my land, Goldcorn, yeoman farmer in the Jeffersonian smallholder tradition. Jeremy, please greet the people.
Hello, people. I wish I was a yeoman farmer. I'm quite good at chopping down trees. Like, my manly farming activities are kind of like George W. Bush, clearing scrub, basically.
With that lumberjack beard of yours.
But farming, my wife and I are very good at killing everything we try to grow, so sadly we will not be eating our own homegrown vegetables.
One day there will be an AI algorithm to solve.
I hope so.
It's been over a year now since we last talked to Kai-Fu Lee, our guest today, and a lot has happened since then, and all of it makes his new book even more relevant, Competition in Technology, and specifically in technologies that are quite clearly going to play a pivotal role in the economy of the near future. That competition has moved very much to the center of the rivalry between the world's incumbent superpower and its most conspicuous rising rival power, China. This competition has given rise to considerable anxiety in the U.S. about China's growing prowess in technology for many Americans who only 3 years ago were still being assured that Chinese technologists were capable only of imitation. The sudden spate of news stories we started seeing in 2016 and 2017 about pretty remarkable Chinese innovation was a rather rude awakening.
The technology that's really at the heart of these new anxieties is, of course, artificial intelligence, or AI. It now touches us quite routinely and holds out this tremendous promise, but also substantial threat.
So Kai-Fu has just published an excellent book called AI Superpowers, and we are delighted that he could take time out of his super busy schedule to join us again and chat with us about the book and about the state of AI in China and the United States and AI as an issue of contention between these two countries. So Kai-Fu, welcome back to Seneca.
Well, thank you. It's great to be back.
Kai-Fu, it's great to have you back. You open your book with something that has assumed a kind of mythic proportion, and it was really fraught with symbolism. I'm referring, of course, to the match between a Chinese Wei Qi, or Go, champion and a Google AI. There were lots of layers to this. Can you tell us why the AI's triumph would be a real Sputnik moment for China?
Certainly. Actually, this began even a little over a year earlier than that with AlphaGo and Lee Sedol, but it was accentuated by the beating Kejie, China's pride. Mm-hmm. Wei Qi or Go was invented by the Chinese. It was believed to be something that required not only tremendous IQ, but also a kind of understanding of the Zen, and then only really super smart people who also have a balanced wisdom can succeed in the game. And also a lot of AI experts in the past, including myself, have projected that AI would not be good enough to beat humans in Go because the game is too large and complex, and it would be maybe another 10 or 20 years before AI got that good. But AI became that good in 2016, and it was a game that China took a lot of pride in, so it became a Sputnik moment for the government, entrepreneurs, and VCs who jumped in and said, we gotta do more with this.
Yeah, it was a pretty amazing thing. I think I was at the time working in technology, and boy, it really rattled people. You talk about, though, this current age as not one of discovery, but rather an age of implementation. So how confident are you that all the major discoveries are tapped out? I mean, what about things like unsupervised learning. I mean, you know, working with unlabeled data, or the possibility, I was just thinking, you know, spitballing, you know, that we can set deep learning to the task of actually labeling data more usefully, at least so that it would be more useful to other AI systems. Is there's got to be more discovery to be had now?
I think most of the scientists who presented ideas like those, reinforcement learning, transfer learning, and ideas you talked about, I view as variations on the theme of deep learning. So the industry, Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon, have gotten very good at tweaking the existing algorithms and making them a little bit better, as have the startups in AI. So the AI used to be very mystical. Only maybe 1,000 people knew how to do a great job. And those people who knew became CEOs, some of whom which are billion-dollar companies now. But the knowledge of how to tweak AI for practical problems has now reached millions of people. I would say millions of people in US, China, and elsewhere are able to take AI on a practical problem, such as finance, retail, manufacturing, education, healthcare, and build solutions that either make money or save money. So I think we've shifted to the age of implementation, where China excels and arguably is caught up with the US and maybe leading the US over the next 5 years. Now, how likely will a research breakthrough, a true breakthrough, come out? I think it's hard to say. It's certainly possible. But if we look back on the last 62 years of AI development, only one gigantic breakthrough, deep learning, has come out. To project that five more will come in the next 10 years would seem a bit unlikely to me.
Sure, sure.
Kai-Fu, one part of the book that particularly resonated for me was your description of Chinese entrepreneurs. And I think Kaiser will probably agree with me that since the 1990s, one of our favorite sort of type of characters, you know, in Beijing and across China has been the plucky Chinese tech entrepreneur who maybe knows absolutely nothing about the field they go into and just through sheer pluck, you know, ends up winning. I think your book might actually be the best book I've seen in English of the history of the development of China's internet as told through this unending series of knockdown, drag out fights amongst ruthless and cunning entrepreneurs. It was really entertaining, as well as being informative. You describe these guys as gladiators who have to go out onto the sands and the Colosseum and fight to the death, which sounds to me like Tuesday morning in Zhongguancun. At first, it was all about copying, the C2C model, copy to China, rule the day. And you said something really interesting, that basically the best thing to come out of the copycat era was China's scrappy entrepreneurs. Could you talk about that a little bit, please?
Certainly. I think Silicon Valley really frowns upon copycatting. First, let me separate copycat from IP infringement. Mm-hmm. We're talking more about Facebook copying Snapchat, something that is legal but frowned upon. That was how China began its internet days, when there was the Google of China, Amazon of China, Yahoo of China, and so on.
I worked for the Google of China.
I competed against the Google of China. I think those companies were just the early days, because imagine at the time Google was founded, U.S. internet penetration was 30% and China was 0.2%. To expect such a small market for people to have the same brilliance, it's not very likely. And also, I certainly concede that someone who continuously copycats and doesn't ever innovate will not be a great entrepreneur, will not become a amazing company, and will not be worthy of respect by other people. But the Chinese entrepreneurs really started by copying and then using copying as a way to understand how to build products, understand customers, iterate and pivot, kind of the lean startup startup process. That got us to a certain point. And then a large market with a huge amount of data took that to the next step. So the Chinese entrepreneurs found that with larger data, they were able to build even better products and apply AI and win more customers. And that just continued to snowball until the Chinese entrepreneurs had enough experience and enough data to really use operational excellence plus iterative company building plus AI to build a lot of companies that don't exist in the US.
Right, right. So you make this very compelling case, I think, for why China will have better data, not just more data. Well, there would be a qualitative, not just a quantitative advantage to China for at least some important applications of deep learning. If I may paraphrase, it's because of these Chinese super apps. You know, we have the Swiss Army knife apps like Weixin, of course, and Meituan and Alipay. I mean, these harvest not just search results and occasional, you know, e-commerce purchases, but actually huge amounts of mobility data from bike share, for example, food delivery, and who knows what else. But you also point out how they can have all this data. And you talk about the two different strategies of going heavy versus going light and contrasting the US and China. So tell us about these qualitative and not quantitative differences with US and Chinese data.
Sure. I think it's actually deeply rooted in the Silicon Valley spirit and the Chinese spirit. Silicon Valley spirit is let's build a tech layer, mm-hmm. Keep a capital investment very light and just do the tech and leave the heavy lifting and the ugly and hard to manage stuff to outsource to other companies or partner with them.
Just so we're clear, the hard to manage and getting dirty, the roll up, what is that? So this is like... Yeah. Fulfillment and...
Exactly.
Right.
So let's take an example. You know, the American company Yelp is a great convenience addition to the way people eat out. But in China, Meituan dared to change the way people eat by delivering food to your home in 30 minutes, including the cooking time, to pretty much anybody's home. And each person would have a selection of 500 or more restaurants that could deliver any kind of cuisine within 30 minutes, and the delivery charge was on the order of 70 cents. So getting to that required incredible AI as well as operational excellence, the nitty-gritty work of, you know, Meituan had to hire 600,000 people, put them on electric bikes with battery changing stations, paid them fairly minimal wages, but with the equivalent of Uber reverse surge pricing to encourage them when to hop on the bike because they could make $2 an hour rather than $1.50 an hour. So that managing that kind of network of operations and going beyond the technical company to go heavy and having to bring so many people on board and deal with all the issues with delivery, dissatisfaction, how to train these delivery people to have sufficient courtesy and feedback and get rid of the people who get fewer star ratings. It's a very heavy, ugly business, also fraught with risk,
right?
Because it had to get to 70 cents to break even. And for many years, it was at $1.70 or $2.70. And at 25 million deliveries per day, $1.70 means you're losing $25 million a day. So imagine the guts it takes to go into a business where you're losing $25 million a day, hoping and believing and chopping off a few cents every month so that you can get to break even.
But the payoff was that now, if data is the new oil, then China is now the Saudi Arabia of data, as you say.
Yes. So the data didn't come from nothing, from just being collected. The data came from doing the operational excellence work. A Yelp could not have that kind of data. And once you have that data, you've also built a very, very deep and wide moat so that your nearest competitor, if they want to copy you, well, are they going to also burn a few billion dollars and iterate and figure out how to do 600,000 people on electrical mopeds?
Huge barrier to entry.
It's a huge barrier to entry. Right, right.
And it's something that's not even possible in the United States. I mean, because of labor issues, right? I mean, you need the Chinese labor pool for this to work, don't you?
Well, sure, there are many factors that go into it, but let's take DD as an example, right? Uber is still a thin layer connecting drivers with passengers. But in China, DD is buying up gas stations, car repair shops, car loan companies, and car leasing companies. They're creating a very tight stronghold for the driver by giving them all these benefits, you know, gasoline, insurance, etc., at a discount. But the moment they put a competitor's app on their phone, they're kicked out. So that would be another way that would keep a very big moat from your competitor.
Wow.
But the high-tech company buying an insurance or doing a JV on insurance or buying up gas stations, that's unthinkable in the U.S.
Right.
But it's actually good business if you could manage it.
So, Kai-Fu, I can see how this amazing data means that the Chinese rocket fuel, to use that metaphor, is higher octane. And this leads me to two questions. The first is, can this advantage travel beyond China, or doesn't that even matter? And the second question is, given that, Chinese rocket fuel is so excellent, how scared should we be of an increasingly authoritarian state armed with pervasive surveillance technology and the world's best AI?
Well, China has traditionally, Chinese companies have traditionally just focused on China because that was a huge market.
And it is a huge market, continuing to grow.
Yeah, and the opportunity cost of going to another country has been not worth it. However, China market is starting to saturate and Chinese companies are now flooded with cash. So they have to sell the next story to the shareholders or investors. So certainly a lot of Chinese companies are starting to go abroad. There are basically two types. One is giants such as Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent, Didi, they're going abroad, and Xiaomi, of course.
Right.
The way they're going about is quite clever. Rather than taking a monolithic platform such as a Google, Facebook would go, they're partnering with the local insurgents to fight against American companies. That is, when Uber is beating up some local ride-sharing company because Uber has better technology, Didi would not only fund and own a part of a local company, they would supply the AI technologies so that the mobile app is more reliable and the rides come sooner. So that's gaining share. Similar things are being done by Alibaba, by investing in Paytm in India and so on. That's the first method. The second method is actually pure digital startups are either going out themselves, such as Toutiao,
right.
TikTok, Douyin. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It is quite popular in Africa nowadays.
It was huge in America. It was like the most downloaded app on the App Store for many weeks in a row. Yeah,
that's right. So it's going abroad. And if the companies themselves are not doing it, many Chinese copycats are copying the Chinese innovations into Southeast Asia, Middle East and Africa, and to a lesser extent, South America. So projected over time, I would expect U.S. to continue to be by far the leader and perhaps unchallenged leader in the developed countries. But in all the other countries, China is pretty much going to be a major force to be reckoned with. On your second question, I don't think the state has the data. I think people assume the state has the data. The state may have some data, but the companies that operate actually own the data. It's rarely taken by the state. We as a VC and our AI Institute have never received any requests for our data. The companies we invested in generally have data requests only when it's a, let's say, government purchased app for a government application. Of course, then they have the data. Or occasionally when they want to essentially issue a warrant for the data. So I think the theoretical concern that a lot of people have just isn't in practice happening.
Kai-Fu, you talk about an important moment of divergence when Chinese entrepreneurs no longer had to tailor their pitches and business plans to the tastes of foreign venture capitalists, but could instead take Chinese approaches to solving Chinese problems. Tell us about that moment and when you realized that it had happened. And correct me if I'm wrong, it was circa 2013.
Yeah, that's about right. I think currently there is a parallel universe in China where the Chinese VCs fund the Chinese companies who build products for Chinese customers, and similar to the correlate in America. I think actually I want to say a few words in favor of America since we're talked about so many great things about China. First, this is not a zero-sum game.
Right.
Because it's not as though Tencent or TikTok or Didi, for every share they gain, there's a loss on the America side. For the most part, the customers are separate. So everybody can gain from AI. It's not that I take $1 and you have one less dollar. The other thing is that the Chinese, behind the Chinese VC, most of the investors are actually American money. So all of us have been working for America, helping to make pension plans, etc., do a lot better than they would otherwise do.
Hey, Cynical listeners. This week's sponsor is YoYo Chinese, an intuitive and incredibly rich resource for students of the famously difficult Chinese language. Since 2012, YoYo Chinese has helped over 400,000 students to learn to speak Mandarin and read and write Chinese with short video lessons, interactive flashcards, study stats, and other tools to help you stay on track and retain what you've learned. Their conversational courses use natural, unscripted dialogues to help you navigate that daunting task of learning tones, sentence patterns, and pronunciation, all the way up to real-life conversations with native speakers. And the character courses cover the 600 characters that make up nearly 80% of all written Chinese. So now you can realize that long-cherished ambition of reading the theory page in the People's Daily. Or just blow the socks off the waitstaff at the local Chinese restaurant. I certainly wish I had this back when I started studying the language. Man, I still remember just slogging my way through a shoebox full of flashcards back at Beijing Language Institute. Anyway, you can sign up and try the first few lessons of any course for free. And by showing your love of our show, you can save 15% off your purchase by entering promo code Seneca before submitting your order. Head to yoyochinese.com, that's yoyochinese.com/Seneca now. And see how YoYo Chinese's unique approach makes learning Mandarin possible. 同志们加油! Now, back to the show. So most of us who've paid a lot of attention to deep learning have seen now how it's been used in things like image and facial recognition, in speech recognition, in translation, anything really that requires you to sift through oceanic amounts of data to show hidden correlations or hidden patterns. What are some of the applications that you've seen Chinese entrepreneurs come up with in the last couple of years that just haven't yet been tried or thought of in the U.S.? Are there some examples of that?
Very few theoretical breakthroughs. Obviously, there are some examples.
In implementation.
Yeah, in implementation, sure. For example, a loan app called Smart Finance that uses data you upload on your phone to the same level as Facebook. It would look at all the data that you're willing to supply, your contacts, your apps, your phone model, your battery level, and 3,000 features are created to determine if you're worthy of the loan or your likelihood of default.
Are there lending institutions using that now?
It can be used by lending institutions, but largely it's basically money from banks that are borrowed to this company, which takes the capital and gives the lending institution a guaranteed interest rate and then keeps all the upside.
And it's opt-in, right? If you are unwilling to share all of your data, you have some control over how much you want to share for processing?
Well, if you don't share, you don't get the loan. Okay. So it is opt-in. If you don't want the loan, you don't have to give the data, right?
Okay, I understand.
I think retail is another big area.
Yeah.
China has been behind the U.S. in retail. Just, U.S. super malls in the last, 2 decades ago were the best shopping retail in the world. And China didn't actually copy that very much because e-commerce was also taking off. But now, China looking back, e-commerce is probably reasonably close to saturation. Mm. And then it's time to think, well, what are the things you want an offline experience? And now it's just the perfect timing because you can put cameras and sensors in stores that can basically measure per user interest, just as though you were an online company. You can also use cameras and sensors to do smart checkout, so you can become cashierless. You can use it to do sales projection, inventory estimates, and so on. So I think China is going to come up with a lot of highly profitable, more revenue and profit per square foot kinds of retail innovations, because now AI can be layered on top of that, taking advantage of the fact that China was behind in retail and now has a chance to leapfrog.
And you think that the Silicon Valley is paying close attention to what's happening in the retail space in China and maybe taking some lessons finally?
I think Silicon Valley generally does not look at China. I think most of Silicon Valley views the Silicon Valley way, the light way, the visionary way, to be the right way, and views China as a copycat, as an insulated market, so it's not relevant. But part of my writing the book, AI Superpowers, is not just for the AI, but to present to American entrepreneurs the Silicon Valley way isn't the only way.
Right.
Here is another way. It may or may not work for you. You may frown upon the approach. You may dislike it. But it would also be very suitable. I personally believe the Chinese entrepreneur approach will be chronicled in Harvard Business Review case studies in the future.
Absolutely.
Kai-Fu, your book talks about the massive growth of venture capital funding in China, and I was astonished. I knew it was big, but I'm not sure if I've got the figures right, but I think it was $3 billion per year in 2013, quadrupling to $12 billion in 2014, and then doubling again to $24 billion in 2015. Is that right? And what is the level for 2017?
I think that number is the cumulative government partaking as an LP in VC funds. That is the guiding funds, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So it's not as large as it seems because the total industry is much, much larger than that. But certainly those are substantial numbers. And those numbers come with some benefits to the GPs. For example, a GP can buy back the government LP shares at an interest rate level within 4 or 5 years. So if you start the fund and take 10% government money and you do very well, you can actually buy back that 10%. And if you had a 40% annual IRR, you only have to pay the government maybe 5%. The rest is yours. So this is the kind of incentive that Israel, Singapore also have.
Right.
And there's a very smart way to invest because no government should become a VC because there are professionals who are good at it. So governments, by picking VCs, giving them some money as passive LPs, and then giving them some additional benefits, that's a very nice knob because the government can choose to give more guiding funds to, say, AI or tech or semiconductor or early stage. So the government's knob becomes at a level where governments can make the right decision, but not at the company entrepreneur level.
Government in China, of course, as you write in the book, has had its hand on the scale to some extent. And clearly with things like, well, the AI plan and with Made in China 2025, the Chinese government, and of course with this extensive funding of, you know, acting as an LP and then giving GPs money and the chance to buy back their shares. It's amazing. But the Chinese government is clearly going to do things like sweep away obstacles in the path, provide certain incentives for entrepreneurs, indeed, maybe even subsidize some of the research in the area of AI. This is what infuriates the U.S., though. This is what really, I mean, for at least in D.C., it's industrial policy, and the U.S. has this allergy to anything. What's behind that? I mean, Japan has long practiced it. South Korea has long practiced it. Germany. Is it just like free market fundamentalism on the part of American politicians? I mean, and couldn't it be said fairly that the U.S., and especially its tech industry, has also been the beneficiary of unstated industrial policy as well? Especially, I mean, the 1960s and the 1970s, with all that defense procurement money going into to really start Silicon Valley in the first place. I mean, your book alludes to things like the Solaris debacle, right? And how it's really turned a lot of people off or reinforced this aversion to planning or to government participation in innovation. I have to wonder, though, what country is actually, you know, more constrained now by ideology?
Well, that's a tough question, but I can tell you what the Chinese government does, and the watchers of the show can decide for yourself whether that's fair practice or not. I think the Chinese government does three key things that make the most difference. One is the central government sets the tone. And actually, those plans, the AI plan 2030, they don't come with funding. They're just the central government saying, hey, this is important.
Right.
And then the individual provincial government and city government and state-owned enterprises and private enterprises can make their free choice on what they choose to do. So given the central government said AI is important, some local government might want to say, well, we are manufacturing, let's do some AI for manufacturing. Some local government might say, we have great universities, let's boost the AI research funding. and so on. And banks will say, well, AI is important. Maybe I'll procure a little bit more AI software. So it does have a benefit.
But signaling and tone setting.
It's really signaling, not the dollars. China is one, not one government, one entity. It's kind of one central government signaling, and then local ones can respond correspondingly with its own budget. The second part is a utilitarian policy, which is rather than vetting all the permutations of issues about a technology, letting it launch and see how it goes. If it goes well, then help it. If it there are issues, regulate it. If there are huge problems, stop it. So that's how mobile payment took off,
right,
and displaced credit cards. I mean, credit cards is basically an additional 2% tax on the American economy. There's no such thing in China anymore, thanks to government's willingness to let Tencent and Alibaba take over, basically. There could be issues with them taking over, but that choice was made because it was good for the people. The third is infrastructure building. So actually, on all the AI companies we funded have been privately funded until recently. And so they pretty much became unicorns without any government help and subsidy. However, the government is pretty smart in actually not messing with the private funding. Where the government puts a lot of money, and huge amounts of money, is infrastructure building. So, for example, Xiong'an, the size of Chicago, a new city, is being built with autonomous driving built in, with downtown separated into two layers, pedestrian, pets, and bicycles on the top, and vehicles on the bottom.
Folding Beijing.
For much better safety, right? And then Zhejiang Province is building sensors embedded in the roads, giving signals to cars to make them safer. So these infrastructure building, I would liken them with President Eisenhower's building of interstate highway, is the kind of thing that no private company can do. But the public infrastructure, very expensive, lots of money. But I would argue that is the role of governments. I don't really see any wrongdoing in that.
Kai-Fu, I think what is missing in the way many people in the West understand China is that they don't really know how the party can set up powerful incentives for local officials. Can you talk about how that works with respect to technology policy? And is it wasteful or actually efficient?
Well, I'm hardly an expert in the area, but I think Chinese local government officials are selected on a number of factors, including their performance in the previous job, their competence, and their intelligence. So I think that is a good first step. And then for the local government officials who start to work on projects, they realize they're essentially lifelong government officials. So if they start a really smart project that takes 10 years to mature, they'll still be in the political system in 10 years and they'll be rewarded for it. So it's a little bit longer term in nature. And obviously, all officials want their local government to build more great companies and get more taxes. But often, intermediate KPIs can be useful for an official to get recognized and promoted. For example, if they start an industrial park and attract multinationals or domestic companies or top VCs and startups. So some energy is put into that so that contribution to the local economy can be measured in a stepwise manner.
That's great. Given in recent years, the new emphasis on ideology in China, how long is it going to be before somebody gets it in their head that AI could succeed where old socialist planning failed? That, sure, you know, the market was better at allocating resources than the command economy was, but wouldn't, you know, an amazing AI-powered system for allocation of resources be ultimately better still? I mean, could they bring back, you know, socialism or even communism now that we have the power of deep learning?
Well, I can't speculate on that. Who knows? I would say the following. First, government AI expertise is not nearly as good as the industrial private, or private or academic, both in China and anywhere else. So that's probably much farther off if it's at all possible. There are examples in my book that talks about the interesting uses of AI in specific applications such as judicial.
Right.
By the use of AI to ensure police interrogation, reports are consistent with the actual interrogation itself using cameras and microphones, examples of using automatic methods to discover contrary evidence in the plaintiff and defendant's list of evidences, and in a sentencing assistant that gives the judge a range of proper sentencing given all the evidence that's been presented. So these products are all commercially developed, but starting to be trialed by the government.
That's great. I mean, you've been dismissive all along, I think, of the nightmare scenarios that people have conjured up about Skynet, about armies of killer robots and that sort of thing. But in part because, of course, you know, as somebody who knows the technology well, just how far we are from general AI, right? We really are. But, you know, of course, you focus on the other dangers. Before we talk about those other dangers, which, of course, is a major theme of your book, and I understand that there are conversations happening around AI ethics. There are conversations happening in China, but it's not like in the United States, where our leading technologists and leading even, basic scientists like the late Stephen Hawking were talking all the time about summoning the demon. My distinct sense is that, okay, sure, we see this on occasional Weibo threads. Jeff Ding has pointed out where there are conversations happening in, white papers written by CAS, CAS, Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, philosophy scholars. But why are Chinese so uninterested in having the conversations about AI? What do you think is at the heart of that?
I think even though China has had this Sputnik moment, the industry is rocketing ahead, most people are not yet aware of this. So, a history professor, a philosophy professor are probably just beginning to touch the subject. So its reach beyond the technical elite is going to take time.
Right.
Second reason is I think Chinese citizens in general sort of look to the government to solve a lot of problems, as opposed to feel like there is a process where the brain trusts produce ideas for the government to consider. So they're kind of waiting for the government to come up with ideas or maybe ask for ideas. And I think Chinese government, like most governments, haven't really done a lot in policy setting in AI yet.
Kai-Fu, I feel like I have to ask this because, it's a comment that a good friend of mine made about your book, and I think you do need to talk to this. I mean, so your cancer scare, confronting your mortality, thinking about, reprioritizing your life, it's made you, contrite about having been such a workaholic. But aren't you investing in a lot of companies with that same kind of insane drive and encouraging them, even if indirectly, to focus maniacally on their companies and their success? The 996 thing, isn't that what you decided wasn't good for your life? Are you making your investees do the same?
Well, we as VCs pick great entrepreneurs. We invest in them. And then we look for results. I think entrepreneurs generally work very hard. We actually try to mediate that by explaining to them results that matter. On weekends, we actually have sports activities so people would make sure they're fit. And we do the best that we can to explain that working hard isn't the most important. It's not the amount of activity that matters. It's the results that matter. So work smart. Right. However, having said that, I acknowledge all of our entrepreneurs work very hard.
Yeah, they should.
It's not an area we push them into. We would like to think that we add a lot of value to the entrepreneurs we fund. And we've actually have five AI unicorns valued at $21 billion. So they've done very well. People are excited. They work hard. I hope the value that we contribute is we have the business sense, we are the tech savvy, and we introduce positive ethics and value, and we help the companies become better companies that way. It's possible our entrepreneurs work 2% less than other entrepreneurs, or maybe they work the same, but I think our contribution isn't in reducing work hours, but in improving the quality of products and that they care about their users and they care about the positive values that they stand for.
That is fair enough. I wish we had more time with you. There's so much more that we would love to ask you, but I want to thank you for making time today anyway. The book, again, is called AI Superpowers, China, the Silicon Valley, and the New World Order. And Kai-Fu Lee is, of course, the author. I cannot recommend it more highly. It's an incredibly informative book, and it actually contains a great deal of real heartfelt wisdom, and it's terrifically written. So before we pack up here, let's do recommendations very quickly. But first, I want to remind our listeners that the Cynical Podcast is powered by SupChina. If you want to show your support for SupChina, for Cynica, and for the other podcasts we've added to our network, we'd love it if you would sign up for our premium access service, which gives you discounts and free admission to our live shows and other events, and ad-free versions of the Cynica Podcast. Lots of other goodies, too. The other thing is, if you want to help us out, leave us a positive review on the iTunes Store. It really helps people to discover the show. Okay, recommendations. Jeremy, kick us off real quick.
Okay, quickly, thanks to SupChina reader Nathaniel Espino for turning me on to the Lutheran insult generator. I didn't know that Luther was
Martin Luther.
Such a good insulter. Yeah, yeah, the religious dissident. For example, you are desperate, thorough arch rascals, murderers, traitors, liars, the very scum of the most evil people on earth. You are so full of all the worst devils in hell. Full, full, and so full that you can do nothing but vomit, throw, and blow out devils. So if you need an insult, the Lutheran insult generator, and its cousin, the Shakespearean insult generator.
Oh, great. I mean, it sounds like Wednesday evening on Reddit to me, but... Great, great recommendation. Insult generators. Kai-Fu, go. What do you have for us?
Okay, well, since we're talking AI, I'll recommend a few sci-fi movies. Some very mainstream,
excellent.
Some maybe less mainstream. I tried to pick the ones that are somewhat realistic or at least have strong lessons for us. I would pick the following movies. 2001, Space Odyssey,
yes.
The Minority Report,
mm-hmm.
Robot and Frank.
Yeah, you recommended Robot and Frank last time. I hadn't gotten around to seeing it.
I did.
Got
to go see that. Gattaca.
Yeah.
And finally, and my favorite is all episodes of Black Mirror.
Black Mirror is fantastic.
And I hate Westworld.
I will talk to you about that at some point. Okay, wonderful. Well, my recommendation is actually for a person who is part of our little group of friends who I've had the chance to spend some time with recently when we were in Hanoi and in Tianjin, Alec Ash, who, of course, runs the fantastic China channel at the LA Review of Books. But I want to recommend him just because he's somebody with whom argument and discussion is truly productive. He's thoughtful and considerate, and he's somebody who will never rise to bait and will always just be gentlemanly in discourse. And I'm so impressed with him. I just find him such a pleasure. Let us all learn from Comrade Ash. Okay, that is my recommendation. And thank you once again, Kai-Fu. I know you've got a super tight schedule. You got to run off. And I'll take it out. The Cynical Podcast is powered by SupChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldhorn and edited by me. Drop us an email at cynica@supchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SupChina News. And make sure to check out our other podcasts, the Caixin Cynical Business Brief, the Pan Daily Tech Buzz China, New Voices, and our latest member, China Econ Talk with Jordan Schneider. More shows coming soon. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week. Take care.